Representative Ann Kirkpatrick has decided to give up her House seat to step into the Senate ring with John McCain. She may be taking that step in anticipation of a pending Supreme Court ruling that could change her district.
We might be better off as a country if we move towards what several other countries like the UK do when they draw constituencies. Here, it's like Lord of the Flies on steroids.
I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, the Hopi tribe wants to stop a French auction. In the midst of a drought, the feds are subsidizing the use of water for cotton. With the Colorado River drying up, how close are we to taking shorter showers? And if you're hungry for variety...
Let's say you're going out to lunch, you got five people, and everybody's got a different taste. Well, you can come in here, and there's four or five different concepts, and everybody could eat something totally different.
And countrymen, grab your swords. We're headed to the park. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Looking for continued sunny skies this afternoon, an expected high of 99 degrees and then nice and sizzling tomorrow. Sunny skies with a high around 103. Currently, relative humidity is at 9%, mostly sunny and 97 degrees. Quick check of valley traffic. There is one accident to watch out for. It's the 60 westbound at the 101. A man suspected in seven robberies across the valley this past Sunday has been arrested. Phoenix police say Scott Michael Walters began his crime spree early Sunday morning, holding up a convenience store in Phoenix. Investigators say Walters eventually held up several stores and banks in Phoenix, Tempe, Peoria, and Scottsdale. Police spokesman James Holmes says once the suspect's photo was made public, they began receiving many calls. An auction house in Paris plans to sell more Hopi artifacts in two auctions scheduled for next month. At least five similar sales have already been held in France over the last few years. Since 2013, the tribe has been working through the French court system to try to stop the sales, but has so far been unsuccessful. Hopi tribal officials held a press conference yesterday to update the media on where the case stands and discuss the other avenues officials are exploring to get the items repatriated. KJZZ's Carrie Young was there and joins us with the latest. Welcome, Carrie.
Hi, Steve.
KJZZ's been following the story since 2013 when items like these first went up for sale in Paris. But quickly, give us a little background. What's being sold and why the Hopi tribe wants them back?
Well, the items being sold are known as Kachina friends. They're used in religious ceremonies and are considered sacred by many Hopi tribal members. Tribal officials say they're living spirits that can't be bought or sold, which is one reason why sales like these are considered particularly offensive.
So what avenues has the tribe explored to try to get them back?
Well, they've already filed three times, according to their attorney, in French civil courts. Those have all been unsuccessful. They're trying a slightly different approach this time. They've filed in a French government court. It's essentially governing auction sales. They have the power to suspend sales or withdraw certain items. So far, though, that court has ruled against the tribe. They are appealing, but they argue the tribe doesn't have the capacity to sue in that court system.
So with that in mind, what are the next steps?
Well, that response is one of the reasons why members of Arizona's congressional delegation have all signed and sent a letter to the U.S. Department of Justice and other federal agencies asking them for help in getting the items returned. Representative Gosar was at the press conference yesterday.
We're asking them to intercede on behalf of the Hopi tribe because of their pathway that they have before legal actions, not only in this country, but across the world. And so we're asking them to step in to help out.
Officials are also trying one more avenue. A group of U.S. museum institutions sent a letter to French President François Hollande yesterday requesting his intervention. The argument there is that when French officials seek to repatriate cultural items of theirs that were stolen around World War II, you know, the courts have always ruled in their favor and we have returned the items.
There seems to be one other option, and that would be buying the items back. Is the tribe considering that as an option or any other groups considering that?
Well, tribal officials have said pretty emphatically no. Tribal Chairman Herman Honani explained the decision a little further yesterday.
Thereby, we would be putting a value on these kind of objects, and we just don't want to do that. We can't go there. And like it was mentioned, that once we start doing that, the value of these objects just goes up.
Buying the items is an approach other tribes have taken in the past, like the Navajo Nation, for example. But Honani says that's not an option the Hopi tribe is considering.
Carrie, any word on why we're seeing more of these sales popping up now? And how long have sales like this been an issue?
Well, officials say it's been an issue for quite some time over the last century. Laws like the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act have been tools that tribes have worked with pretty successfully to get items back that are held in the U.S. But the fact that these sales are being held overseas changes the game a little. Attorneys are a little worried that people are selling the items, that they're seeing that they have an avenue for sale in places like France, and that's why these are popping up a little bit more now.
KJZZ's Carrie Young. Carrie, thanks.
Thanks.
For the past several months, University of Arizona students have been taking a survey of low-income households across Tucson. Brian Mayer is an associate professor at the U of A School of Sociology. He and his students recently presented their findings at the Poverty in Tucson Field Workshop. Brian, how did this idea come about, and was Tucson a good place to study poverty?
Well, in 2012, Mayor Jonathan Rothschild was elected to the mayor of the city of Tucson, and he made poverty and addressing Tucson's persistent poverty problem a priority for his administration. And I had just recently arrived at the University of Arizona and was very much impressed with the pedagogy, with the idea of teaching students about poverty by having them go out into the community and talk to people living in poverty. And since Tucson has a very high rate of poverty, about 25% for our metropolitan statistical area, Tucson is actually a really interesting learning laboratory to learn about what is it that drives people towards poverty, what is it that keeps them there, and how can we help those households rise up and out of poverty.
There are so many perceptions that people who haven't lived in poverty may have. Were there certain myths that, based on the results, can be kind of dashed, and if enough people hear about this information, that perception may change?
I think that there were two myths that were explicitly dashed by our study and by our students' experience. The first one was the idea of people in poverty are lazy. In fact, most of the people that we talked to were employed if in one job, but also in multiple jobs. Some people were retired and on fixed income, but we had about 60% of the people that we talked to were at least part or full-time employed. So this was not a population that was just sitting around taking government checks. And that gets to the second myth, is that people in poverty are completely dependent on the so-called welfare state, just taking government money in order to get by. In fact, the people that we talked to were very, very not reliant on government assistance. In fact, the government program that 71% of the people relied on wasn't welfare or cash assistance. It was SNAP. It was food assistance. When we looked at other sources of government assistance, most of the people didn't report using any type of government assistance. And in fact, most people reported not even using charitable assistance. Over half of the people that we talked to that lived in poverty reported never reaching out to a church, to a nonprofit, or to another charity for help. So this was not a very dependent population, and this was a very working-oriented population.
When it comes to not reaching out for assistance, was that because of pride or because a lack of awareness that those opportunities were out there?
I think both of those things were operating. A lot of students came back and talked about social stigma, the problem of being seen as taking a handout, being a reason why people would not go out and get assistance. We heard a lot about that even when it came to food assistance, the idea of going to a food bank and being standing in line and being seen by your friends or colleagues for hours, often waiting for these places to open up, was seen as very stigmatizing. And so there was some avoidance. But I think the primary reason that we heard was a lack of knowledge. We measured people on their income levels and classified them either in poverty or extreme poverty. So extreme poverty would be making less than half of that poverty threshold, right? Very poor. More than half reported never using any form of charitable service. And then when it came to government assistance, it was very similar, and these people would certainly be qualified. So I think both of those things are going on, a lack of knowledge as well as a social stigma.
What now can be done? Is there progress to be made in Tucson thanks to some of this information?
I like to think so. And certainly when we proposed continuing this class, so this has been the second year that we've offered this class, we went to nonprofits. And what we talked to them about was both providing this experience to students, right? We're educating the public through our students about the problem of poverty, but we can also turn around and give them data. And what they told us was, you know, they have really good stories. People come to them with their problems and they hear about those stories, but oftentimes what they lack are really good numbers beyond what census can give them. And so what we want to see happen are these data and the reports that stem from it help these organizations apply for grants that can help them increase their service delivery. So we're trying to both help the nonprofit as well as the city's administration and the nonprofit community with these data so that they can help target services to those that need them the most.
Brian Mayer is associate professor in the University of Arizona School of Sociology. We've been talking about the Poverty in Tucson Field Workshop. Brian, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
As the clock ticks toward the end of the U.S. Supreme Court's latest term, lawmakers, candidates, and potential candidates are waiting for the decision on Arizona's Independent Redistricting Commission and whether the current congressional districts will stay in effect. If they don't, the current makeup of 5 Republicans and 4 Democrats could tilt dramatically to the GOP. David Wasserman is House editor for the Cook Political Report.
The Supreme Court is attempting to decide whether it's appropriate for citizen-led commissions to redraw political boundaries rather than state legislatures that dominate the process in almost 2/3 of states. So in Arizona, where the commission process in 2010 produced a map with several competitive districts, there's a potential for a Republican governor and legislature to redraw the boundaries in a way that could cost Democrats several seats. It's also possible that the ruling, if it extends to California, which is an unknown as well, could cost Republicans several seats in the Golden State.
Now, is there a possibility, we've heard mention of lawsuits, that Common Cause has talked about this, that regardless of how the Supreme Court rules, there are going to be efforts to try to make sure that the maps as they've been drawn by these independent commissions could stay in effect. Is this something you'd give any weight to?
Most reformers of the redistricting process, most reform advocates, see this lawsuit as something that that was a nuisance to start out with. I don't think most reformers guessed that there would be a real chance the Supreme Court would side against these reform initiatives that have taken power out of the hands of the politicians who have traditionally drawn the lines. It would be a huge setback to advocates of reform if the Supreme Court were to strike down this commission, because reformers have argued for years that voters should choose their politicians rather than politicians choosing their voters.
The most negative perception of politicians is, of course, that they look out for their own interests. And I know that's why people have been concerned about lawmakers drawing the districts, because they tend to draw them so they're beneficial for the people actually doing the drawing. Should there have been a real concern about how those districts were drawn?
It's kind of the eye of the beholder here. Democrats would contend that the map maximized competitiveness, and that's a quality that should be revered in the process, whereas Republicans are arguing that Democrats exerted an unfair influence over the process. Neither party is 100% wrong, and neither party is 100% right.
What would be the problem with having there be some sort of federal commission that drew the districts for the states? Is that too much of a taking away states' rights?
We might be better off as a country if we move towards what several other countries like the UK do when they draw constituencies. It seems to be a simple bureaucratic function every several years. Here, it's like Lord of the Flies on steroids. It's our national cartographic nightmare.
David Wasserman is House editor for the Cook Political Report. David, thank you for the time.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, some valley farmers have taken advantage of federal subsidies to grow a lot of cotton.
There is a glut of cotton on the market now, and the price has dropped. And so the cotton that's being produced in Arizona today doesn't really have anywhere to go.
Later this hour, details of a ProPublica investigation. It's the show. Good afternoon. We have entered the hot season officially around the valley. Should be sunny with a high of 99 degrees today. And then coming up later on tomorrow, sunny skies, a high around 102. For this weekend, we might get real close to 105 degrees under sunny skies. It's currently mostly clear at 97 at KJZZ. To the Valley Freeways, an accident I-10 westbound at 7th Street. That's causing a pretty heavy backup for a couple of miles. Also a collision 60 westbound at the 101, blocking the shoulder. It's 218.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, announcing their seafood extravaganza with a selection of fresh seafood and shellfish flown in daily. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
Storage related to the reality of living in the desert, Arizona has received some credit for being better prepared for extreme drought than neighboring states, especially California. But a new investigative report by ProPublica indicates that federal funding for cotton growing in Arizona could be leading to troublesome water wasting. Abram Lustgarten co-wrote the report. He focused on the community of Coolidge.
What was most surprising to me in learning about this process, of course, farmers both meet a need and make their decisions independently about what to plant, and that'll have an environmental footprint in terms of its water use and other things. But what we'd found in particular with the cotton is that the decision process was being warped, sometimes against the best judgment of the farmers we were talking to, by the role of federal subsidies in that process. That's to say that Arizona farmers started telling us that they wouldn't necessarily still be using as much water as they were using if the farm bill subsidies weren't encouraging them to do so.
And you focus a lot on one farmer. Did you feel like he was completely upfront with you? And if he was, did you understand where he was coming from? This idea that, okay, maybe I feel slightly guilty about this, but it's how the system works?
I spent a lot of time with Greg Wirtz, and I do think I understood, both sympathized with his task and his history, and also understood where he was coming from. I've also spoken with a lot of farmers, a lot of ranchers across the seven states in the Colorado Basin, and the kind of conflicted feelings that Greg Wirtz had were not unusual. You know, a real caring and awareness of the water constraints that the state is facing, a real understanding, a technical and a scientific understanding of the role of his crops and his business decisions in that water use, and yet a real candid acknowledgement of what that means for the long term for the planning and the budgeting of water in his case in Arizona. What it comes down to, I think is a real reflection of how difficult it is to take water and drought into account in planning these long-term, planting decisions for these big farms.
Was there part of you that kind of shook your head thinking, wow, cotton in the desert at a time when we're in one of the worst droughts we've seen in perhaps hundreds of years?
Yes, by the nature of the fact that it's one of the most water-intensive crops and wouldn't grow on that scale in that desert without the imported water. So very much, that's part of the reason for the reporting there.
Is this cotton used in a productive way in any sense? How much of it is wasted?
The answer to that question depends on when you ask it. The current state of affairs is that there's not a lot of use or demand for the cotton that's being grown in Arizona. And that's part of what was most interesting in my interviews with Greg Wirtz. The market paid a premium a couple years back. Arizona cotton farmers planted a lot of cotton and the market was flooded. There is a glut of cotton on the market now and the price has dropped. And so the cotton that's being produced in Arizona today doesn't really have anywhere to go. Greg Wirtz tells me that his marketing co-op will essentially hold that in storage until they find a good buyer. And the market's flooded by production in places like Texas, which produce a whole lot without irrigation, and countries like China, which produce more than anywhere else in the world. So there's not, at the present moment, a huge demand for cotton. That's been different in times past, where there's both been a demand and a real need for cotton for various products, from the clothing that we wear to the tires that we drive on, and so forth. And so the answer to that changes depending on when.
Based on your reporting, is there anything to indicate that when people hear more stories like this, there might be more momentum to change things?
Among the opportunities or the potential solutions, if you see this as a problem, is not necessarily to take farmers out of the equation or to make what they do any less important, but perhaps to use the water and to have them farm something that that meets a stronger market need and has a smaller water footprint. Research through our reporting showed that if for example, Greg Wirtz or other cotton farmers transferred their acreage to a different crop, say wheat, which could be potentially equally profitable for them, it could substantially reduce the water footprint and the water demands that are weighing on the state of Arizona.
Abram Lustgarten of ProPublica. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry.
Here's another surprising detail about the Western drought that we would not even be learning if it wasn't a statewide emergency. Ian James, environment reporter for the Desert Sun, says water users are supposed to have valid permits, but he found hundreds of expired water permits issued to ranchers, farmers, and landowners who are tapping springs across California national forests with no drought concern and at almost no cost. The biggest producer of bottled water in the United States, Nestle, draws its water from Strawberry Canyon just north of San Bernardino National Forest. And James found that the company has such an expired permit dating all the way back to 1988.
We started looking at bottled water plants and trying to assess, you know, how much water they're using from what types of sources, and that ended up leading us to the San Bernardino National Forest. And it turns out that a number of the permits that relate to water, including one that's used by Nestle for bottling, a number of these permits have their expiration dates long in the past. So the Forest Service hasn't kept up with a large backlog of permits.
Why has the Forest Service not been able to make this a priority? What other demands, are on the Forest Service right now?
Well, the Forest Service says that over the years, they've had staffing shortages, budget issues, and then wildfires, and that other types of permits, such as power lines or new railway lines, have been priorities. Some former Forest Service officials have told us that funding is a major problem, that they don't have the staffing to be able to do the reviews required under modern environmental laws, you know, looking at what are the impacts of extracting the water.
And you found someone who really remembers the good old days when water was much more plentiful in the state of California. Here's Gary Ernie, who's a retired U.S. Forest Service employee.
When this forest experienced its first major budget cut in 1981, that was a 46% cut. We have had cuts since then in the early 1990s and again in the mid-2000s, around 2006 or 7. This national forest and most of the national forests in this region have been cut below the bone. They simply cannot do the job that the public expects anymore.
And one of those jobs is making sure they know where the water is going and who has a permit to take it, right?
Right. The Forest Service acknowledges that one of its central missions is not only looking at and safeguarding Forest Service lands, but also the water resources. So that's something that for a long time, Gary Ernie says, hasn't been done adequately because of the staffing levels, the budget situation, various reasons. And when we looked at these permits, we found 1,108 water-related permits, a lot of those for pipelines. And of those, 616 permits are listed as being past their expiration dates. And the average of those was about 12 years out of date. And so I think it'll be very difficult for the Forest Service to take on all these permits at once. They have said that they will make it a priority to look at the permit that Nestle uses for the pipeline that draws that water from the springs in the National Forest.
And is this a situation where Nestle, for instance, or other users of the water resource have not paid some fee, have not contributed some revenue to the state treasury?
Those fees haven't been looked at in a number of years, so a number of them remain rather low. For instance, Nestle pays $524 per year for that pipeline. But the Forest Service says that the permits will remain in good standing while it considers renewing them.
How old is some of this stuff? How far back does it go?
The permit that Nestle uses for Arrowhead water actually predates the company's ownership of Arrowhead, and it lists an expiration date of 1988. The thing is, if they haven't been looked at in many years, that means also that the Forest Service hasn't studied these uses under, you know, the Endangered Species Act, other federal laws, to look at what are the impacts of withdrawing that water. You know, what does removing the water from those springs do to the streams below them and, you know, the birds and other wildlife that are there? And some former Forest Service employees say that's a very big concern as this drought wears on.
Ian James, environment reporter for the Desert Sun, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. A third of the Navajo Nation is now covered with sand dunes, the result of climate change. Roads, corrals, entire homes have been buried in sand, creating what President Obama calls, quote, climate change refugees. From Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
30-foot-tall sand dunes, the color of flower pots, flank the road to the now dry Tulani Lake on the Navajo Nation. At one time, streams flooded the road. Today, it's sand. The community frequently bulldozes the dunes, but they creep back as much as 40 feet a year.
I mean, it's a losing battle, unfortunately.
Margaret Heza Red Steer points to a dune blowing towards someone's home.
They have to plow the road quite frequently to keep the road open so they can get in and out to their house.
Heza Red Steer is a research scientist for the U.S. Geological Survey. She's been studying Navajo sand dunes for 15 years.
I'm really worried about Navajo people and concerned for their welfare.
Heza Red Steer says the current drought combined with increasing temperatures are making it harder and harder to live in these harsh conditions. On this clear spring morning, the sun is already blazing hot.
That's pretty intense, isn't it?
It is.
Heza Red Steer says the Navajo are not simply victims of something happening hundreds of miles away. Many Navajos work at the largest coal-fired power plant in the West, on the reservation itself. The EPA says such power plants are responsible for almost 30% of the country's carbon dioxide emissions, which contribute to climate change. When you add up sand, the heat, water scarcity, and dust storms you can see from space, you start to hear terms like uninhabitable. That's the word Carletta Chief uses to describe parts of the Navajo Nation. She's a member of the tribe and an assistant professor at the University of Arizona.
People live in these homes and they have to either continually shovel the sand dunes back every time, or I've seen in some cases like in Kienta where they've built barriers.
For the Navajo, the land where you are born is sacred. And generations ago, the federal government allotted each family a parcel, a permanent homeland.
And even to move from one community to the next is nearly impossible because your ancestral land is where your family has lived for many, many years.
Traditional Navajo people subsist off the land. Researcher Margaret Heza Red Steer says many overgraze their livestock, and that's left the land barren. Without plants to hold the land in place, the sand dunes become mobile. One invasive plant has made matters worse, tumbleweed. Yes, that romantic symbol of the American West is a scourge of the Navajo landscape.
We have these new sprouts of tumbleweed coming up.
Heza Red Steer plucks a baby tumbleweed out of the sandy ground. She says the tumbleweed, or salsola, chokes out native plants that hold the sand dunes in place.
It's very effective at drawing moisture out of the ground, much more effective than the native plant species. So during a drought, the salsola will get the upper hand simply because it's more efficient at drawing moisture out of the soil.
Then, when the wind blows, the tumbleweed detaches, tumbles, and spreads its many seeds. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Sir Duncan Bain Forbes, and we are at Encanto Park Wednesday night fighter practice. We study all aspects of medieval times. So the chivalry, the armor, lords and ladies and things like that.
My name is Sarah. What we just got done doing was a melee. Melee essentially is like our little practice for wartime. It gets your heart pumping, you know. There's something completely different about coming out here and just getting bull rushed by someone who you don't know and them laying you out flat that just makes you smile.
What kid has not wished to be a knight in shining armor? That dream has stayed with me my entire life.
That was William Tucker, also known as Sir Duncan, and Sarah Kuchik practicing their medieval fighting skills with the Society for Creative Anachronism in Encanto Park. If you've got ideas that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we need to be more chivalrous, email us the show at kjzz.org. Coming up, as business looks to profit from the growing solar industry in Arizona, an effort to self-regulate emerges.
We can say these companies, we've vetted them, they've met these standards, and we stand by these companies.
That and more just ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, an accident I-10 westbound at 7th Street blocks the shoulder. There's also a collision on the 60 westbound at Dobson. That one's blocking the right lane. Valley weather for the rest of this afternoon. It will stay sunny and hot. No surprise there. We should warm to 99 degrees. For tomorrow, sunny with a high of 102. This weekend, sunny skies continue as well, with high temperatures getting close to 105. Currently, relative humidity is at 9%, mostly sunny and 97 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by Area Agency on Aging. June 15th is World Elder Abuse Awareness Day. 1 in 9 older Americans is being abused. Information about educational events being held in the Valley can be found at aaaphx.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Former House Speaker Dennis Hastert has been indicted on federal bank-related charges. Prosecutors are accusing him of structuring the withdrawal of nearly $1 million in cash in an effort to avoid bank reporting requirements and then allegedly lying to the FBI about the withdrawals. Banks are required to report cash transactions of more than $10,000. President Obama says climate change may be playing a role in intensifying hurricanes and storms and their resulting damage.
The best climate scientists in the world are telling us that extreme weather events, like hurricanes, are likely to become more powerful. When you combine stronger storms with rising seas, that's a recipe for more devastating floods.
Obama speaking after touring the National Hurricane Center in Miami today and receiving his annual hurricane preparedness briefing. The hurricane season begins on Monday. Although Houston got a break from storms today, the rain from earlier in the week is pushing rivers there and elsewhere in Texas above flood stage. That includes the San Jacinto River in suburban Houston. Homeowner Joy Rizzi says deciding whether to stay or leave is a tough call.
If we leave, we're at risk of, you know, not knowing what we come back to. And if we stay, then can we get out? Are we going to get trapped?
One byproduct of all the rain, an influx of snakes. Wildlife Removal Services say they've received reports of hundreds of snakes in homes in Houston and North Texas. Sepp Blatter, the head of soccer's world governing body, FIFA, says although the organization is beset by a massive bribery and corruption scandal, he is not to blame.
I cannot monitor everyone all of the time.
Blatter is dismissing calls to step down. A number of current and former top FIFA executives are facing criminal charges in the U.S. On Wall Street today, the Dow closed down 36 points to end the session at 18,126. The Nasdaq Composite Index was off 8 points. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. From subsidies and permits for water rights in the old days to permits for internet rights and subsidies to ensure maximum access in the internet in the future, Federal Communications Commission Chairman Tom Wheeler is circulating a plan today to extend broadband service to 12 million low-income households who currently receive phone service subsidies under a federal program called Lifeline. Victor Picard joins us. He's an assistant professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism, and the Future of Media Reform.
So we've got these 12 million households that get a federal subsidy under Lifeline. What would they be extended under Wheeler's proposal here? What would they get?
Well, ideally what they would get is subsidized monthly access to broadband services. Right now, Lifeline comes out to somewhere around $9.25 per month for telephone services. And the idea now, and like you, I'm just reading about this today, and I don't think any of us have seen the specifics, but this would now extend to broadband services, and it's this recognition that we now need universal service, universal access to broadband services in the United States.
Is that capability available? I mean, compelling companies to offer services? I mean, I'm presuming that the companies would be reimbursed so that they wouldn't feel the pain of the subsidy. There's plenty of room in bandwidth to offer 12 million people that kind of service, right?
Well, that's the assumption, but right now we still, even though this sounds like something for the 1990s, we have an enormous digital divide in this country. And so with millions of people lacking access to broadband services, this is an assumption that this is at least a small step in that direction to help bring people, give people access to broadband.
So without programs like this in the future, you'll only see poor people at the movies. You'll only see poor people, you know, finding entertainment that they can't obtain online. They would go to public facilities, maybe bars, to see these kinds of entertainments. I mean, you can't really imagine what the digital divide would mean in that circumstance.
Right, and I think what you're referring to there is this kind of almost cartoonish notion of what broadband means for people today. I mean, in many ways, this is no longer a luxury. It's a daily necessity for Americans, ranging from everything from trying to find jobs or getting access to educational services, healthcare services, connecting with family, emergency communications. These are all things that we're increasingly reliant on with regards to broadband internet.
So what are the arguments going to be against this as Wheeler's plan circulates among the FCC commissioners and seeks public comment?
Well, of course, you know, there's going to be two sets of criticisms, I believe. One is going to have to do with there are often concerns about fraud, that people who shouldn't qualify for lifeline subsidies are somehow able to get access to that. But I think the bigger, more important critique is this assumption that the market, we should really leave this up to the market, that the market should be able to provide universal broadband access. And right now, we're simply not seeing that. There's a strong empirical record showing that the market will not take care of this, that the internet is a public good, and it will require government intervention to try to make sure that everyone has access to it.
Do economists know a cutoff below which households typically can't afford broadband? Is there, you know, in the same way that we understand who's under the poverty line, is there someone who's under the digital divide based on income and assets?
There are criteria, and some of that was discussed in today's New York Times article. I mean, generally speaking, we do know that this digital divide disproportionately affects low-income Americans, minority groups, and other studies have shown that of all the reasons for why people might not have access to the internet, it's often because of the prohibitive costs. Many Americans simply can't afford it.
In certain markets. Victor Picard, assistant professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks so much, Victor.
Thanks so much, John. I enjoyed it.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. There have been some setbacks in the solar industry in Arizona as a few companies have looked to downsize here and expand in other states in response to action by the major utilities. But overall, solar is growing, and with any industry that's getting bigger, there are potential problems that can emerge. That is in part why the Arizona Solar Energy Industries Association is holding a sales and ethics training session today. Corey Garrison is the association's preferred solar installer program chair.
The training is a prerequisite requirement to be in the preferred solar installer program. It's basically a process where we as Arizona have put this together so that we can pre-vet basically the companies that are putting forth the effort, taking the extra training. I'm not saying that other companies wouldn't or haven't, but it's really a program that brings a kind of an independent third-party industry self-policing kind of thing to it, to where we can say these companies, we've vetted them, they've met these standards, and we stand by these companies that they are going to do things ethically.
When the training is done, what are some of the things that are emphasized as it relates to ethics? Are they sort of basic things, or are there certain ethical things that really apply to this industry?
Some things apply to the industry. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, with a lot of help and guidance from the utility companies on rate designs and structures, what
we see in the industry to what the utility companies say, you know, would be appropriate things that they see based on all the data that they get to see. What I mean by that is we really dive into looking at rate design, system design, how it associates to different rate structures in that class, and, you know, what we as an industry feel is a good standard to go by.
We've been hearing so much of late about complications in the industry, whether it's with rates. We've heard of certain companies that were not based in Phoenix that are, or based in Arizona that are moving out and whatnot based on certain things that are being done. When we shine a more of a light on the industry, does that make it even more important to have really reputable companies doing it so that there are no other complications, no slippery slope, as it were?
I could agree with that. My concern with that would be I don't know what companies, other companies do. I know what we do. When you get into this, we're just trying to go ahead and set that standard now and get out in front of any type of potential that there could be. But that, again, correlates with the program. We have a certain threshold that we want this company or these companies to meet, and they usually meet it or exceed it.
You're seeing a lot of growth, I imagine.
In this particular market, it's not as much as we would like. Nationwide, we are seeing an explosive growth in certain states. In Arizona, I think that, you know, we're seeing continual growth, but not at the rate that you see nationwide.
In an industry that is associated with Arizona, because people think solar, even if you look at the numbers and maybe other states are doing more, this is a state where people think about that. Is that part of this as well, this idea that because it's an industry that people hear about a lot, there may be some people who want to get into it and may not have the ethics training you're talking about?
Again, we're trying to get out in front and set the standard before there's a concern that we don't have a standard, if you know what I'm saying.
Corey Garrison of South Face Solar. We've been talking about the Arizona Solar Energy Industries Association sales and ethics training. Corey, thank you for fitting me in. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
By 2017, chances are a shortage will be declared on the Colorado River. If that happens, Arizona will lose a significant share of water, more than any of its neighbors. Farmers will feel the squeeze first. And as KJZZ's Will Stone reports, that's forcing some tough decisions about how to keep agriculture viable as the drought deepens.
On a windswept late spring afternoon, Brian Betcher cruises a labyrinth of waterways lined with ripening melons and corn.
This is kind of the southern end of the district. You see we're up against close to the foothills, and we're kind of near the edge of where water is below ground.
Betcher is spending a lot more time recently concerned about that very issue. He manages the 200-plus miles of canals and pipelines that make up the Maricopa-Stanfield Irrigation and Drainage District. At the edge of the canal, Betcher stops at a recently installed pipe.
The challenge we're looking at as we get to 2017 is that we need to maximize our ability to get this groundwater into our canal system.
2017, when Arizona faces a good chance of its first cutback in Colorado River water, depending on the level in Lake Mead. Central Arizona farmers will be among the first to take that hit. 50 to 70% of the water flowing into this irrigation district comes from the Colorado. That could drop to only 20% after a cutback. Groundwater will make up the difference. That's what farmers relied on before the Central Arizona Project, or CAP, piped in water from the river.
We're dealing with old infrastructure we're trying to bring back online. We're cautiously optimistic we'll be successful, but there's no guarantee because these wells have been sitting here a long time not used.
This uncertainty, coupled with the loss in overall water, will force growers to adjust. After all, groundwater is more expensive.
In central Arizona, CAP water has been the way we irrigate our crops, so that all changes.
Joe Sigg is with the Arizona Farm Bureau. He says growers are in the midst of some key calculations. Which crops can be grown with less water? Will fields have to be fallowed? What if equipment breaks? Will banks still offer the same loans?
Historically, margins on agricultural crops are 3% or less, and oftentimes we're dealing with margins of 1% or less. So a little change in expense can cause a margin that's, let's say, marginally profitable to one that might be negligibly profitable.
We are in the middle of not a welcome experiment, but an experiment that will tell us what kind of decisions the farmers will make over time.
Sharon Megdal is director of the Water Resources Research Center at the University of Arizona. Shortage or not, agriculture here was already set to lose its share of the Colorado River by 2030, the assumption being urbanization would drive that. This drought may just accelerate the transition. In the short term, though, McDowell believes many farmers will return to groundwater. For how long, it's hard to say.
Now, the good news is groundwater levels in that region have gone up because people have been using the surface water.
That's the Colorado River water.
But over time, if groundwater continues, then we're going to see a decline in water in storage, and that's going to be a concern potentially for future water supplies.
Back in Maricopa, Brian Betcher shares that concern.
There's going to be some tough decisions that the landowners will have to make. Is just because we can pump 200,000 acre feet a year, do we want to do that for the long term because what that might do to your resources below ground?
In the 50s and 60s, reliance on groundwater here depleted the aquifer, eventually prompting legislative action in the form of the Groundwater Management Act, which restricts pumping. Could we come close to that again? We'll consider that more closely tomorrow. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Good afternoon. It's 2:49. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. In Valley traffic, couple of big trouble spots. I-10 eastbound at Washington, the right lane is blocked. And on the 60 westbound, an accident at Dobson blocks the right lane. Eastbound at Mesa Drive, the right lane is blocked. Sunny and 97 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by APS. APS is putting the sun to work for customers. Their solar partner program is bringing more rooftop solar to Arizona and helping APS plan for a reliable energy future. APS.com/next.
The past decade or so has seen the Valley becoming more of a haven for unique, dare we say, hip, locally owned restaurants. And according to numbers put together by the Arizona Republic, zip codes that include those eateries have seen the average home price climb faster than other parts of the Valley. Mark Stapp is executive director of the Masters of Real Estate program at ASU. He's not surprised that people are following their taste buds.
We're maturing as a metropolitan area. And as the millennial population emerges into the consumer segment of their life and they're now making their own choices as to where they live in greater numbers, you know, the ability to have social connectivity becomes really important. They're not just digital natives where they're socially connected through technology, they're socially connected people in general. They like to bump into each other. They like to be able to walk places. They like to engage. You know, you look at, I think for the first time ever, restaurant sales outpaced grocery sales. It's not a surprise to me at all that you see these neighborhoods that have the eateries becoming really desirable.
So the zip codes that may be more flush with the chain restaurants, even if some of those chain restaurants are very popular and well-liked, having an eatery maybe put together by a local chef is more likely to maybe reflect a neighborhood or a zip code and then sort of play into those things you're talking about?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that's the genuine, that's the unique. When you've got something that's not formulaic, that is dynamic, that's original, we need those kinds of things to be happening, but they come with conflicts also. Many times they create conflicts because they attract people into the neighborhood that don't normally live there. It creates traffic, creates parking problems. That's just part of us growing up as a metropolitan area.
I think there's a perception, at least, that when people think about hip eateries, that certainly in the context of zip codes, maybe they're thinking of zip codes where you've got a little higher income level. Yeah, it's helping these certain zip codes, but those are zip codes that maybe these restaurateurs were aiming to go into anyway because they were slightly more upscale.
Certainly. Okay, there's several things that correlate to this phenomenon. Good housing stock, close to other kinds of amenities. It's a combination of things, Steve. I think the hip eatery by itself isn't going to make the place, but there's no small coincidence that that eatery, if it is successful because it's related to this bigger context in the neighborhood itself.
Mark Stapp, Executive Director of the Masters of Real Estate program at ASU.
It's time to head to another Valley Hot Corner, spots with a lot going on. But first, as always, let's meet our tour guide.
I am Gwen Ashley Walters, and I am a food journalist for Phoenix Magazine.
Where are we?
We are on the corner of Roosevelt and Central Avenue in Phoenix.
And this is a pretty new place we're at.
The building is not new, but the
What's inside now
it's called
is new.
DeSoto Central Market.
The building itself dates to the 1920s, and in its early days was a DeSoto dealership. But now, instead of cars, you'd go there shopping for food and drink.
This is a food hall, which is a national trend right now, and it's a combination of different independent restaurants sharing space in one gigantic building, and it's fantastic. I'm so excited it's here.
Why all the excitement? What's so great about it?
It's great for diners to come into one place. Let's say you're going out to lunch, you got five people and everybody's got a different taste. Well, you can come in here and there's four or five different concepts and everybody can eat something totally different. And it's just a community space. You know, it feels, it's beautiful, it's industrial, chic, it's just gorgeous, and they want it to be a community gathering place, and I think it's fantastic.
This in some ways reminds me of kind of like, and please don't, you're going to groan when you hear this comparison.
Okay.
It almost is kind of like the food court at the mall. Much nicer and different restaurants and not chains, but a similar concept, right? A bunch of different places all under one roof in one space where
right.
if you go to work with five of your coworkers, if you go to lunch,
right.
everybody can get what they want.
Exactly. And I think that is a fair comparison, but this is way cooler than a food court at a mall. And it's a trend going on nationally. You're going to find them in any city that you go to. And it's not a new trend either. But for Phoenix, this is the first time that we've had a collection of independent restaurants concepts together under one roof, sharing space, sharing synergies, sharing customers. It's just fantastic.
So what do you think it says for Phoenix and Phoenix's food scene that we have one of these now?
We're arriving. I'm not going to say we're there yet, but we are arriving. This is a big deal, and I think this is great. This is the work of some very forward-thinking people.
What does it take for a place like this to be successful, and is that different than just a standalone single restaurant?
Well, first of all, I think there's a couple of different answers to that, but location is really important, and right here being on the corner of Roosevelt and Central with the light rail here, plus being part of this redevelopment of Roosevelt Row, that is important because there are people here, and they're going to come and then they need to eat. But this particular kind of concept, it's really untested here, other than the food courts at the mall, but you have the shopping there, and that's why they have food there. That nobody's really thinking about that kind of food. The kind of food you're going to get here is extremely thoughtful, extremely delicious. Each concept is completely different, and I think that you need to have people who can work together and serve different kinds of things, and it's brand new, so we'll just see how it plays out. It's going to grow. There's still a couple of spaces open that they're targeted for some people, but they haven't actually filled it all the way out yet. But come next fall, I think this place is going to be fully up and running, and it's just going to be awesome scene.
So along Roosevelt Row, obviously, as you mentioned, there's a lot of stuff here. We did a hot corner a little bit south of here.
Right.
So this already, it seems to me, is kind of a hot corner already. Mm-hmm. So what does having a place like DeSoto sort of add to it that maybe makes it hotter or just like continues the trend
the
of
hotness.
It being hot? Yeah.
I like this particular spot again because of the kind of market that it is. It is a food hall, and that's something that Phoenix does not have right now anywhere else. I think they chose to locate here perhaps for a couple of reasons, because there is critical mass now of, if you look at around us, there's been lots of residential development in this area and more on the way that we've been noticing. So I think the critical mass of people were here. And they're actually probably building on some of the other people along Roosevelt Road that came in. There's one, and then shortly after that, another one comes on board. And then it's like a snowball rolling, and then you just get more and more excitement. And people are really excited to have new places to come and eat.
So would this be less interesting to you somewhat if it weren't a food hall and the first of its kind in Phoenix, if it were just
another restaurant, a single standalone
restaurant?
It probably wouldn't have caught my attention as much, though. I mean, I always celebrate every new independent restaurant that opens up here, but I don't think it would draw as much of attention as it's drawing now because it is a food hall.
So having a concept like this, mm-hmm. along with all the other stuff around here, mm-hmm. to you is what makes this an interesting interesting location now.
It is now. And again, they're just in their infancy. I think there's so much potential for this building and what their plans are, their vision for the future to have even more things open. Even a farmer's market, they're talking about doing that at some point down the road. And now they've got the summer to kind of go through and you know, let's build some traction, let's build some, get these guys that are already here and committed, make sure that they're successful, and then go ahead and finish out the rest of the concepts.
Gwen Ashley Walters is a food journalist for Phoenix Magazine. We met at DeSoto Central Market on the corner of Central and Roosevelt in Phoenix.
Arizona's Surplus Property Office holds its live public auction just 3 times a year, and the next one is this weekend. Although you can find some items online year-round, everything from a window air conditioner to a 2007 Ford Crown Vic, there's something to be said for the rush of a live auction. It's what some call auction fever, the hype that auctioneers generate to quickly increase bids. The show's Annika Klein found out some auctioneers are worried that online bidding reduces the auction fever effect.
20, 20, 20, get a book, 20, give me $10 on
it. This is what a live auction typically sounds like. And this is what an online auction sounds like. That's part of why Charles Delaney, the auctioneer you just heard, says he's hesitant to start an online bidding service through his auction house.
The whole momentum of the auction gets ruined with the online bidding, absolutely.
$1, $2, $2, $2, $3.
The auctioneer's strange cadence has a purpose. John Morgan is a professor at the Haas School of Business at Berkeley and researches online auction markets. He says a lot of different factors determine the perceived value of an item.
Who's there, how the item is being sold, the room, the display, and it's not something that's determined in a vacuum.
Morgan says live auctions generate the phenomenon known as auction fever, which can lead to higher sale prices. But he says online bidding can have a different psychological advantage.
It's something called the endowment effect.
In auctions, the endowment effect happens when a buyer starts to feel that they own the item they're bidding on.
And the more ownership you feel over the item, it turns out, the higher is your willingness to pay for the item.
Items like the ones sold by Scottsdale Auctions and Appraisals might take more time to ponder. They sell historic Native American and pre-Columbian pieces. Jennifer Wingate says they knew they wanted to auction exclusively online when they started a year ago. Merchandise is put on the site a few weeks before the deadline to bid.
That gives bidders a chance to preview the items and they can leave absentee bids.
The longer time frame allows customers to contemplate the item, request more photos, and maybe start to feel like it's theirs. Back at Delaney Auction, about 400 items are cleared out in a single night. Doing this online would be tough, but Delaney admits it's probably inevitable.
We will have two locations, though. It'll be two separate entities.
That way, the online auction world and the live auction world won't collide, and the customers can take their pick. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
Be with us tomorrow for Friday's edition of the show when we'll hear from a Valley doctor about why he went to Liberia to help Ebola patients and why he may go back. And we'll learn about the impact of former Phoenix Suns leaders on the two NBA Finals teams. That and a lot more tomorrow afternoon, starting at 2. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is up next. Have a great afternoon. It's 3 o'clock.